Session number 11289, rule 1.
Mr. O'Leary, rule 1. Can you tell me where you were born and something about your family background, please?
I was born here, in Port Talbot.
What did your father do for a living?
He worked on the docks, what they call a coal trimmer. If you don't know what that means, the anthracite trade for Canada was the main source of work. And they would pour from a tip, truckloads in, and resulted in a big mound sticking out the hatch, so they'd be down below levelling it.
Was he Welsh or Irish?
No, Irish. Irish born, and my mother was Irish born. I went to St. Joseph's School, which is the Catholic school there. I had a scholarship to the secondary school. I had my, what we call the Central Welsh Board, and that was equivalent to a pass to go to college. I didn't go because you had to have a guarantor, because in those days you paid. And I knew my parents couldn't possibly do it. So I, without telling them, I went down the docks and I got a job in the Merchant Navy. I had a cousin on this ship. My older brother, who had been to sea for years, found out, and when that following morning when I sneaked off, supposedly to school, I went down the ship and I was slung off it. Anyway, I didn't go to college. My father wasn't very pleased about that.
So you started did you start a career in the Merchant Navy?
No, I didn't go to the Navy. My brother put a stop to that. My father said, well, why don't you join the Navy, which I didn't fancy at the time. And I went up to London then. I hung around here, I had a couple of odd jobs. So I worked up in London then from about 1935 till the war was nearly starting.
What jobs were you doing in London?
Oh, all around London with a construction firm, you know. Steel erecting, everything. I worked from as far as Grays, down the Thames, Dagenham, Rumford, Harrow, Southall, Ealing, all around. And I came home, my mother started getting worried and all that. My sister wrote to me. So I came home here and I worked here then. I went down to the dry dock. Port Talbot, and from there to the Navy. I always liked the sea, of course. I didn't want the army. I've lived quite close to the sea all my life. I couldn't think of anything else. I'd be heartbroken if I'd gone in the army.
And what was your training like in the Navy?
Well, it was all, I went to Ganges for 6 weeks and it was all seamanship training. And then they shipped us off down to outside Gloucester to under canvas. That's where I did all my wireless training, signalling training.
What did that consist of, the wireless training?
Well, all the procedures, nothing technical then, purely operating. They brought us, taught us how to read. Well, the first night there, they gave us a signalling form and said, you better know your Morse by the morning. You know, this did da, did and all that. And surprisingly, we did. Then we started on the quay. It's very, very slow Morse. And it lasted, say, 5 to 6 months. And each day, it just always seemed a struggle to get it down. But that was the idea, of course, and we suddenly found we were reading Rugby Press, which was about 24 words a minute. And when we passed out, I think it was 22 words a minute, it was quite easy. We also did a writing test to see if we could write fast and legibly, you know.
Had you been in a reserved occupation in London?
Pardon?
Had you been in a reserved occupation in
London? No.
So
this was a reserved occupation, the docks.
But the building industry wasn't?
No, not then, no. Pre-war it was up then, the building industry, and the war just started, I came down. This was a reserved one, and if I wanted, I could have had them to get me an exemption. But I wanted to go to the Navy, my brother was already in it, my younger brother.
So were you a conscript or a volunteer?
No. I was called up, but I could have got off, I could have had an exemption. And I went in. My younger brother was actually a militiaman. You know, they signed on the dotted line when they were 20 in the event of a war. So that meant he should have been called up immediately. And he wasn't, and he worried and worried, and I wrote to Bath, I wrote to Cardiff, and they finally called him up. And he spent 6 weeks in the underground caves in Chatham. He was sick of the Navy then. Oh, Lord. No, I could have had an exemption in the trader, but I didn't want to. And I was working on trawler conversions, you know, and I'm looking forward to it. I got on to MLs. I didn't want big ships, and I think there were about a dozen of us from our class who were Devonport after finishing training. And we slept first night in the gym. It was jammed, the messes, well, I don't know, my pre-war idea of opium dens, I think. It looked in, little blue light, hammocks at all levels and all angles. Hopeless. We slept 12 in a bed the following night outside. And they were bombing blazes out of the place. And they were calling out non-stop all day long. They were commissioning two cruisers at the time. Anyway, out of the 12, there was only myself and a boy from Barry left. So we went into the signal office. We wanted to get out of the place. And I made a little tentative suggestion, all three badge AB. Jock, what's the chance of getting on top of your boats? Oh, come in. We're off the following day up to Fort William. It's Miss Christopher. And I met a lot of chaps up there who I ended up ultimately in my flotilla, but we travelled down as a full crew, you know, because when you're up there you had to do a bit of gunnery, seamanship, stoker in the engine room, mechanic, like you had to be able to do a bit of everybody's job. So we travelled down then to Brixham, and we were in civilian homes there, because our 446, my first ML, wasn't built. It was being built in Falmouth.
Why were you so keen to serve on motor launches?
I don't know. I fancied a small ship, you know, and the only small ship I could think of was a torpedo boats. I didn't know anything about MLs or MASVs or MGPs, nothing then.
Can you tell me what an ML was like? Can you describe them? The size and the speed and so on?
Well, maximum speed, I imagine, when they're brand new and in the pink of condition, supposed to be 25 knots. But I can give you a photograph of one if you want, a snap of one.
If we can describe it in words, though.
Yes. It was 110 foot long, 17 foot beam, 4 foot draft. We had, at the beginning, a 7-pounder at forehead and a couple of twin Lewis and a Holman gun, which was for throwing depth charges.
Were they any good?
Well, they certainly would throw them. A Y-shaped, you know, and you'd have one on each side and the carrier would go overboard with the... Yes. The only other alternative you had was to roll them over. Out of the chocks, see? We carried, I think, a dozen depth charges. And two would be on the gun. Later on, of course, they put all things up forward and aft.
What size of crew would they have?
There were 12 and two officers.
What would the crew consist of?
Coxswain, motor mechanic, aztec rating, wireless, seamen and seamen gunners. As I say, you'd make in no cook. One of the crew had to do that, and for that he'd get threepence a day.
What rank would the officers have?
On an ML, Touringer, perhaps both would be lieutenants, usually a sub-lieutenant for number one. And when he got sufficient experience and he got his second ring, well, then they'd give him a boat of his own, see? If in a flotilla, you usually had at least a 2.5 rings lieutenant commander. Sometimes a commander would lead the flotilla.
And who would be the senior petty officer on an ML?
Well, you wouldn't have one unless it happened that the motor mechanic might be a petty officer. We had a leading hand as a coxswain. And usually, but not always, we'd have a petty officer motor mechanic. Then you might have one seaman amongst the crew, not the coxswain, with Killick. Leading hand, and invariably they'd all be brand new hostilities only. You might have, we started off with a coxswain who was a failed fleet air man. He'd been a pilot with British Airways, I think was the name pre-war, but he was enormous, big fat, and he was just too heavy, so he was a CW candidate aboard us.
A what?
A commissioned candidate, a CW, and he did 3 months just to get sea time. Then he went into King Alfred, but usually he'd be just a leading hand.
And what was the accommodation like on ML 446?
Well, we had in the galley flat, as you come down, you know, from the upper deck down, there would be the galley, the wireless office, coxswain's cabin, coxswain's heads. Then from midships forward would be the crew. In harbour, lovely. At sea, terrible.
Why was it so bad at sea?
I've seen chaps thrown out their bunk, literally thrown, and waking up on the floor, not knowing where they were. So you'd always tilt, you had two beds which you could fold up to the ship side. And if it was really rough, well, you simply tilted the ropes up, tied it up a bit higher, you couldn't possibly be thrown out. And it's indescribable. I thought I'd never get used to it. And when we first started from Falmouth, our patrols used to be down to the Scilly Islanders, you know. And once you passed Land's End, it could get awful. You'd be sick. You get back to Falmouth, they'd say, I'm getting off these. But the minute you've got your foot on dry land, you'd forget all about it. And suddenly it stopped like that, you know, got used to it.
The seasickness.
But they're very, yes, they were very, very uncomfortable. I've seen men hemorrhaging even so much they start hemorrhaging, you know. In fact, when they fitted mines aboard us in Jib, it was crowded, the ship. There's even Yankee naval officers aboard there. And there are two old chiefs who had been to sea all their lives, chief torpedo men. And they were sick. They were sick. We were laughing our heads off. The only thing that brought a smile to their face was the fact that we used to get neat rum on those boats. And that cheered them up immensely, but they were sick. I felt chuffed about that.
But when you say you got used to it, you mean that after how long would you...
Suddenly, say, give it a month or two, and it stopped. Suddenly stopped worrying me. So what used to get me going, I was stuck in the wireless office, and it was the heads opposite, and alongside with a locker. We used to try and put cheese and things like that, you know, to keep cool, not to be in the galley, and that invariably would spew and be all sorts of mess all around the galley flat. Oh dear, dear. And the stink of that half the time, and the smell of the paraffin stove we had, see. It had lovely looking burners, you know, and all that, but you had to pump it up, and that used to stink because that used to spill all over the place, paraffin all over the floor. But it's something you get used to. God, you used to zoom, really zoom. One thing about an ML, you do float to the top of anything, and you could tell down below the way it was going up, whether it was going to drop into the trough the other side or go down. You could feel what was going to happen. I'd gone up to the heads one day, which was right in the bows, and we had a normal toilet, you know, but you could pump salt water in and flush it, see? And I wanted to be sick, that's why I went up there. And I was hanging on, and you'd up and down, and you'd bend your legs ready for the drop, and it came down, and my knees crouched, and another one hit us aside, the portal burst open, the water came through, and all the salt water in the pan came up over me. Oh, that's what it was like. And you'd think it was someone with an enormous sledgehammer hitting you underneath, and you'd think the boat was going to fall to pieces. The worst thing, the only thing I ever seen, one day going down to two of us, the second boat I went on was with when I was originally on 341 with 446. We got into the Scilly Islands, and he was in our company, but you'd only see him occasionally when he'd pop on a top of wave. Well, he didn't turn up, and we had to go out to look for him. He was flooded completely through the top deck, and took a pasting, that boat did. But anyway, as I say, I enjoyed them thoroughly in the end.
So when you first joined Motor Launch 446, it was doing patrol duties off the Scillies?
Yes.
In the Western Approaches?
Yes.
What was the idea of those patrols? What were you looking for?
The convoys were coming in, and the e-boats would be down there waiting for them. So we used to go down and patrol. We'd base ourselves in St. Mary's in the Scilly Islands, and we'd do perhaps a week down there patrolling out from there. And then another one would come down, and we'd go back, and the next time out we'd probably come round to Appledore.
To where?
Appledore, across the water there.
Appledore?
Yes, and we'd patrol then up for anti-sub patrol for all the convoys, you know, that's coming up the Bristol Channel. Then go back to Falmouth.
How often did you come across e-boats?
Once, thank God. I tell you what we did down there. And picked up airmen, you know, that had been shot down, unfortunately, lovely and calm. Picked up a whole crew of, what was it, a Lancaster, I think it was. And one of them had a cut on his eyebrow. And they asked us, were you shaking like a leaf? And I said, this chap, what's the matter with him? He's pretty rough. No, he said, he panicked, and one of the boys hung one on him to snap him out of it, you know. So I shouldn't say this. I give him a drop of rum. And he'd always be having these sneak raids, of course, in convoy, but the good thing about that was they weren't bothering with us. The convoy. Mainly we'd be doing on around the channel anti-submarine sweeps. Well, you always kept your Asdic going anyway. He was always permanently on watch, and when he wasn't on watch, they could switch up to the bridge.
What's happened on the occasion where you came across the E-boat?
Well, the E-boat was skirmishing around at the convoy, and we were the only one there, and he was, they like little destroyers, and we had torpedoes on at the time, and our skipper was trying to get, and he was a good captain, he was trying to get in, we couldn't tackle him with arms, we had this 3-pounder on us, and he was trying to get in a good position to torpedo. He fired a few, raked a few of the boats and away. He was on his own. But they're like destroyers, you know. They're not torpedo boats. They're enormous.
So, an E-boat was much more powerfully armed than a motor launch?
Yes, it's like a destroyer. Oh, they're terrific boats. And speed galore, you know, 30-odd knots. And very heavily armed. Usually, as you can well imagine, any action between fast boats, it's only a matter of a few seconds. And if one doesn't clear, they turn around, have another go. It's like two planes. You know, they have a go at each other and then they're past, manoeuvring.
Did you have any submarine contacts?
Ooh, out the Med, plenty. In the Med.
In the Western Approaches?
No, we didn't, no. No, not one.
What about these...
They used to come the, out here. The, I remember one evening I was working in the dry dock there at, and I was catching the launch by the lock gates to go up to the docks we ship. And this was in 1940. There was a boat called the Stahlheim going out, and it's the most unusual merchant ship I've seen, because you didn't go right down the bowels of the ship to the engine room. The engine room was sort of halfway down between decks. It went out the lock gates, it got between the two piers.
Torpedo?
No, mine. Submarines were laying them. Laying mines there. And it's a magnetic one. I knew the pilot very well, Mr. Gunn. And it turned out he broke both his legs. But he managed to clear the channel. At least it didn't sink in the channel. And, quite a lot killed on it, of course.
This was at Port Talbot?
Yes, just across over there. And you see the pier down there now, but it was a wooden one then and a stone one opposite. Subs were doing that.
Now, you were based at HMS Fort.
Yes, at Falmouth.
Can you tell me what about HMS Fort, what it consisted of?
Well, it was the coastline's shipbuilding firm, and we simply used their facilities, and their offices were our headquarters.
And you were part of a motor launch flotilla, were you?
Yes, the 28th flotilla.
How many motor launches were in there?
We had 8. But, of course, most of them went to Saint Nazaire.
Can you tell me what you remember about the Saint Nazaire raid in detail, as far as it affected you?
Oh, yes. We had... We left on the 26th of March, I remember that well, it was my mother's birthday. And we left about 1:30, and it was nothing... Nobody could have hidden it from anyone that something wasn't up. We had been taking commanders aboard and doing night raids down on the Scilly Islands and all that, you know, and we were told we were to be getting them ready to the sea, to get used to the sea. Oh my God, they used to be sick all over the place too. Well, they sat on for weeks, and one night, on St. Patrick's night, I was going to show them with a couple of friends to a dance.
What date is that?
17th of March, it was St. Patrick's night. And this coxswain came in, he said, "We can undress," he said. All leave stopped. And that night we up from our moorings by coastlines and we went out to St. Maur's Bay and dropped the anchor. Now what had happened, the buzz had gone round that we were training the commanders for a raid over there. And we had a fella, Butcher, Thomas Butcher, he was a stoker. He was an active service rating and he had been around and he said to our skipper, his own skipper, "I think we're going to raid that St. Nazaire over there," he said. Our skipper just simply told the higher-ups, cancel all leave. And we were out there for a fortnight in St. Maur's Bay, twiddling our thumbs. And then the Princess Charlotte came, and of course we knew then they started having all the crews over there and briefing them. And we went out of Falmouth on a lovely sunny March day at 1:30, I think it was in the afternoon. Two lines of MLs, Campbelltown in front, the gunboat stern, towing the little torpedo boat. And we went well down past St. Nazaire. Lovely weather it was. A lot of phosphorescence. We were a spare ship. By spare, I mean we carried torpedoes and we were to stay ultimately till the last case of stragglers coming back. Well, 3-4-1, the one I was on abroad, about 8 o'clock in the night, where we had doubled round, oh, we met two trawlers, yes, two minesweepers, and signal come down the line for us to pull out. We were spare, and I can't remember which destroyer put up the swastika flag and tore away down. They were astern of us, and we didn't want them probably to radio, I expect. So we went in their wake, and they signalled us to back up a bit and wait. They went down, steamed right between the two trawlers and around the other side, still flying the swastika, and we rejoined the rest. And then at 8 o'clock in the night, 3-4-1 broke down. They put Tebbets, I think, the engineer, aboard it. She was completely deaf, and all the commandos all came on to the spare boat, our boat. The others, in the meantime, had carried on. And it was... we caught up with them going up the estuary. There was a submarine outside, and they knew that two was missing. So the sturgeon, she stayed on top. I saw the A flashing. So I give her the U, I think it was, instead. And we caught up.
What did the and U mean?
Oh, just the recognition signal, you know, from the submarine that was keeping watch surface-wise, that no ships there. And that it was all clear to go in. And at high tide, the destroyer only had barely sufficient room at high tide to go in over the flats, see. But we had all the room in the world. We only drew 4 foot of water anyway. And we got upriver and it took out place in the station as searchlights came on.
As what?
Searchlights. One well ahead, one just astern of us. And then, in no time at all, I don't know, it was lit up like Christmas. I think what happened, more than anything, you imagine 16 motor launches, an awful drone with them. And that's it.